I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of May. The New York Times had a front page story on May 10 on nail salons in New York City, the working conditions, the pay, the hazards, the workers. If you've ever had a manicure or a pedicure, if you plan to have another and you read this story, you will enter your next appointment with new eyes and perhaps with deep concern. Our guest for most of this hour has written a couple articles for The Nation on the nail industry. One of the articles, 90% of the over 10,000 chemicals in nail products have not been evaluated for safety. And another in which she asks the question, how can you get an ethical manicure support worker organizing? This hour, we will have two guests with us. We will be speaking with Michelle Chen, who wrote the aforementioned articles for The Nation. She's a contributing editor at In These Times, a contributor to Working in These Times, and an editor at Culture Strike, a co-producer of Asia Pacific Forum on Pacifica's WBAI, and her work has appeared in a number of publications. Later in the hour, the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health's executive director, she oversees and develops campaigns and advocacy work. As a result of the New York Times piece, Governor Andrew Cuomo decided to start regulating the nail industry in New York City, and so she will talk about what kinds of regulations will be put in place. We welcome your phone calls during the course of this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. If you ever have gone to have your nails done or your toes done, and you read this article, did it change the way you think about salons? Do you think that something needs to be done? Was there information that was really new to you? And in terms of buying the products, are you aware of the number of chemicals that are put into nail polish? It's incredible. Or those acrylic nails, even worse. We welcome your phone calls. Let us speak with Michelle for a while before we start opening up our phone lines. Michelle, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
This was a huge story, and I'm glad you're writing about it as well in the New York Times, that uncovered an industry that, you know, way in the recesses of our minds, we might think there might be something wrong because of the way everything smells, the fumes, et cetera. But, oh, my goodness, the problems in this industry are enormous, aren't they?
Yeah. If you just think about, you know, we think the nail salon smells bad when they're in there for a half-hour treatment. Can you imagine spending your entire workday in there every single day for years and years? And that's what these workers are exposed to. And it's sort of been a problem that's been hiding in plain sight in many communities.
It's just not been investigated. Your piece and the piece in the Times talk about the number of hours a day nail workers at very low wages spending 12 hours a day in all of these chemicals, and they don't, many of them wear masks or wear gloves.
Yeah. And there are serious chemical hazards associated, not just short-term issues like breathing problems and headaches, but really long-term things, disruptions of reproductive health, even cancer. And these are sort of, you know, they're known through research, but there's actually sadly been very little on the ground epidemiological studies that are specific to workers in this industry. And there needs to be more research, but given what we already know, there also needs to be some real action taken.
Mm-hmm. And what about just the products themselves? Is there regulation of those nail polishes and those acrylic nails?
Actually, we're sort of in a state of the industry right now where consumers don't even really know what's in the products. I mean, the FDA has very lax regulations on labeling for these products because they treat them as cosmetics. Therefore, you know, they're not quite as seriously overseen as, say, you know, medicine, which on the one hand maybe seems reasonable for an under-resourced agency like our FDA. But when you think about it, I mean, these are things that people are often much more exposed to on a day-to-day basis. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration also monitors these in terms of workplace safety and health. But again, enforcement is always a problem. And in a lot of these businesses that operate in this sort of like quasi, you know, semi-underground network of shops that are scarcely even really licensed, you know, much less regulated by any federal or state agency. It makes it hard to make sure that bosses, you know, first of all, know what to do, what the right thing to do is for their workers, and also can take the necessary steps.
It's my understanding that even though you're working in an area where there are numerous health risks associated with your job, very few of these workers have health insurance.
Yes, there's a high rate of uninsurance. I mean, these are basically low-wage workers. They're like low-wage workers in any industry. They're exposed to unique health risks in this industry, which makes health insurance or the lack of health insurance that much more of a critical issue. But, you know, another thing that should also be noted is that these are mostly, you know, typically the women doing this work are women of reproductive age. And they work in this industry for years and years. In many cases, it's heavily concentrated in immigrant communities. And so you're creating a very high concentration of people who are facing extremely often devastating risks. And that can spill over into the next generation, as you saw in the New York Times investigation. You know, there are signs that this is affecting, you know, women who have children.
Mm-hmm. And yet there hasn't been any long-term study done. You would think that maybe as a result of all of this investigation into the industry, there will be health studies done to show the consequences of working with these chemicals.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, to be fair, the California Healthy Nail Salons Collaborative, they've done some very good work in terms of just getting out into the Vietnamese immigrant community, which is where a lot of these salon workers come from in California. And, you know, they've done field research in terms of interviewing people, getting them to report on their symptoms, et cetera. But, you know, stepping back a bit, you know, we already actually know a considerable amount about the types of hazards that people are being exposed to, at least. And when we put that together with the heightened vulnerability that low-wage workers experience in general, there's no reason not to take action right now.
You talk about a heavy concentration of Vietnamese workers, particularly in California. Why are so many of the workers Asian workers, and in California, Vietnamese?
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, immigration story, actually, which is, you know, one of the areas that we might sort of lose sight of when we're discussing, you know, purely the health impacts. But, there's, you know, this has been a mainstay of many, Asian immigrant communities. I believe the Vietnamese industry has actually been going, for a number of generations now. Many of these people came as refugees, so they were already in a very tight-knit network. People, and there were the programs in place that would allow for, first of all, people to get trained in the nail technician skill area and also to launch businesses. I mean, this is an industry that where, you know, getting a licensed business set up is fairly, the barriers to entry are fairly low. There's a high demand for these services. And, of course, the darker side of this is that the immigrants that these people hire, many of them may have marginal immigration status. They may not be able to get a job that, for instance, requires you know, much English-speaking skills. So this is an industry that they're often relegated to. And so there is this supply of you know, people who are willing to work for low wages, and that's an unfortunate aspect of this. On the other hand, some people see the nail salon in the Vietnamese refugee community as a success story because many of the owners are also, you know, immigrants themselves. So, you know, there's ambivalence around that. But if there's a way to get the entire community engaged, then that's really vital.
The stories that we've read about recently indicate that many of these young women, they're usually young when they start, don't get any money at all, have to pay a salon in order to get a certain amount of training. And then when you're up to par, you can get a very low wage salary. For some workers, it might be quite some time before they get a salary.
Yes, which is not only, you know, not really legal, but also kind of smacks of indentured servitude. And a lot of the people that come into this industry, I mean, they are in situations that are akin to some form of labor trafficking. And, you know, if you're basically starting off essentially in debt, right, and you're an undocumented worker, you're in an extremely coercive situation. You know, these workers should have legal recourse. Unfortunately, the way our immigration system is set up and the way our labor regulatory system is set up, it's really driven by workers daring to come forward and often, you know, at great risk to themselves and their families. And for workers who are very socially isolated, both, you know, formally and as well as informally in terms of just where they are in society, that's often a very difficult, you know, task for them. And you know, on top of that, they're suffering these massive health effects. So, you know, this is sadly a reality that many of them are dealing with.
You talk about what's going on in California, and the Times article, of course, concentrated on New York City. Do you imagine that these kinds of conditions are universal to all places in America?
Well, the Times had some interesting statistics on the remarkable concentration of nail salons in New York City. For you know, a city like this, it's a very dense city, but there's an extraordinary sort of, you know, per capita number of nail salons, which of course is in part a function of the fact that these workers are so, this labor is so cheap, sadly, in California as well. So New York and California are kind of the two hubs. But in reality, I mean, this is kind of, you know, one of these modern indulgences, sort of a contemporary luxury that is becoming more and more widespread. That's driven by the fact that the labor needed for this kind of service work is relatively low cost, as well as the start of opening up a business is relatively low cost, and also just the fact that, you know, as women have more disposable income, they're spending more on stuff like this. And, of course, that's often driven by marketing and driven by the fact that maybe, you know, this is one of the few indulgences that working class and lower middle class women can afford.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting image that you ask us to put in our minds. Luxury today, you write, is often measured by the distance between the worker and consumer experience. The invisibility of the field worker picking our strawberries or the obscured human face bent over our foot bath. Consumers demand toxic-free toys for their kids, but seldom clean air or pesticide-free neighborhoods for those workers' families.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's telling about the way our very consumption-driven economy works. And it's also a statement on just inequality in this country. And, you know, hopefully things like this, these new insights we're getting from the nail salon industry can get people to think about, you know, who is that worker sitting across from me? And it's interesting because, you know, this is also a statement about a very gendered workforce working in a very gendered industry. You know, who pays the price for one woman's beauty? And it's often, you know, on the other end of that equation is another woman who's placed in a very disempowered and often very risky position. You know, I don't have any grand insights on what individuals should do with that, but hopefully it can sort of enhance our sense of, you know, who provides the labor in society. Our consumption-driven society is very much built around the fact that we are increasingly detached from the source of our products.
We're going to welcome phone calls from Michelle, and here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Michelle Chen wrote a couple articles about the nail industry for The Nation, and many of you, I'm sure, saw those, or you saw the New York Times expose that was really shocking, that ran front page on May 10, a real examination of this industry that probably not many people think about. Have you thought about this when you've gone to a nail salon or had a manicure or a pedicure? Once you are armed with this kind of information, what do people do with it as consumers? And what about consumers of the products, this industry? We have to ask Michelle. She writes 90% of the more than 10,000 chemicals in nail products, 10,000 chemicals, what are they in nail products, haven't been evaluated for safety by any independent agency prior to marketing. So there's a problem with the products that are on the market, to say nothing of the people who are putting the unsafe products on the market on your nails or on your feet. We'll welcome your phone calls in just one moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The nail salon industry, this hour of the show. Michelle Chen wrote several pieces for The Nation on this. She is also a contributing editor at Dissent, where she hosts a podcast about various labor issues, and she does writing for many other publications. All right, phone lines. We're going to go to you right now or send an email. Our number 800-486-8655, and we start with Kathleen in Waukesha. Hi, Kathleen.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Ms. Chin, and thank you, Kathleen, for this subject. It's one of which I've actually had a long interest, not the industrial side, but the health issues. I believe that it was in Houston, Texas, and I may be wrong on any of these facts, so I don't have the information directly in front of me, but I am pulling over from driving. Allegedly, from my memory, 19 babies died in an NICU in Houston, Texas, and it was all traced back to fungal infections from the fake and acrylic and nail things worn by your nursing assistants and your nurses. No nurse, no nursing assistant, no dental assistant should be wearing fake fingernails. Also, if you go back and review the tapes, Paula Abdul, in the later years of American Idol, she has a great big, I believe it was on her left thumb, she has a great big huge bandage where she got an infection from some kind of salon. And what can happen with these infections, because the fungi, it's a fungi, not a bacterial usually, and they're very difficult to treat because there's no air getting to the nails. You can have to have I'm not saying Paula Abdul, but there are cases where people will have to have their fingers amputated.
Oh, my goodness.
Because of these infections. And if you have any comments, and if I'm totally wrong on it, I would love to be corrected.
Thanks very much, Kathleen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular case in Texas, but you're right. I mean, in addition to just the general chemical hazards that people face on the job when they're exposed to these fumes, and these chemical irritants on their skin, infection is a huge problem at salons. And actually, one of the recent investigations by the authorities here in New York into nail salons was actually driven by concerns about consumers, getting infections from dirty foot baths, improper, unhygienic conditions in these salon workplaces, and just a general, transmission of bacteria and other things like that. So there are all sorts of, bacterial and infection risks as well. This is real, we're getting into some medical territory here in terms of how invasive and how much of your body is exposed in these transactions that we're used to seeing as just purely cosmetic.
And do you know, are there rules in various states, and if it would be a state decision or a federal decision, that nurses are not allowed to wear these artificial nails?
I was not aware of that. I don't know of anything related to that. There might be, I'm sure the nurses' unions would know more about this, but, it does seem to make sense when you're in a setting that's very sensitive in terms of the medical setting or other fields like that, where you're working with young children, that's definitely a concern. But of course, let's remember that many of these workers go home to their kids as well, and they work in the salon until they're pregnant. So, this is happening in places outside of the ICU.
Thank you, Kathleen, very much for your call. Kay in Madison, hi.
Hi, I just got a manicure, and I had read the two articles in the New York Times, and I asked the woman who runs our salon, who is Vietnamese, if she had read the articles, and she said no, but that a lot of her customers were commenting on them and asking about them, and they made comments about $10 manicures in New York, and the going rate over here in Madison is probably $25, give or take. And it makes a difference. I think you get what you pay for in more ways than one in terms of hygiene and sanitation and people making decent money for their work.
So as you got your nails done today and you were armed with all this information, how did it, if at all, change your nails experience for you, Kay?
Well, it really enlightened me. And it saddened me. I've been to a place that I thought wasn't very sanitary. I went in there one time just because my regular place was real busy. And I just didn't feel it was sanitary. And so I would never go back there. But the place that I go to is always clean. And, in fact, the owner said spends an hour every week, every night after everybody else leaves cleaning. Because she said, I care about this place and I'm the owner. And she said that makes a difference in terms of how hygienic it is.
Michelle.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's it's important to recognize that these are workplaces, but they're also community spaces as well. And, you know, if you can approach this dialogue with sensitivity and care, you can both learn a lot and maybe sort of help spread some useful information. In New York City, they just launched a volunteer-led sort of Know Your Rights campaign with volunteers going across the city, you know, giving literature to workers and consumers about the health conditions and the health risks involved in salon work, encouraging workers to come forward to learn more about their rights in the job, minimum wage, things like that. And it's important to recognize that this is both a labor and a health issue. It's a consumer rights as well as a workers' rights issue. And the more we can do to bridge that gap, that knowledge gap, as well as that sort of empathy gap, I think that's really useful. And, you know, I think there's been pushback from salon owners, and I think that that's unfortunate because, you know, what everyone wants is to be able to get a safer and more ethical, you know, manicure. The solution is not to shut down every salon in the city, but rather to make them better and more equitable.
Well, and then you have all the living conditions that are just atrocious for many of these immigrants who are packed into very small spaces. They all work and they get up at the crack of dawn and trucks pick them up in the morning and they're gone for 10 to 12 hours. And it's just horrendous.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually a hallmark of many of these immigrant service workers, you know, from domestic work to nail salons, you know, and also just, you know, working in warehouses and things like that. I mean, there's workers are basically sleeping in modern day tenements, and you know that is sadly all that many of these extremely marginalized and also in many cases undocumented workers have access to.
Kay mentioned the going rate in Madison for a manicure at a nice place is about $25. Are we able to put a price on what's going to be a decent amount to pay that will be fair to the workers if the workers are getting a portion of that, a good portion
of
that?
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, the last part is key, right? I mean,
right.
It's you can pay, you know, there can be a range of prices, and I think that $25 sounds about right for New York City, but how much of that actually gets to the workers, you know, we don't know. Probably depends on the size of the workforce, the relationship between the employer and the employee. And, you know, unfortunately, if you have workers who are basically bonded labor, right, and they're not making any wages for the first 6 weeks on the job, they're already, you know, they're already working, you know, they're starting out in debt, essentially. So this is not an equitable labor arrangement whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kay, very much for your call. I wanted to go back because I can't imagine what would be in, why you would need 10,000 chemicals and what in the world they could be to put in nail products. You see 10,000 chemicals, do we at least know which ones of those are particularly dangerous?
Well, the EPA has done some, health environmental impact studies, and I believe the FDA has at least, you know, considered the research that's out there, but, you know, a lot of this stuff is in medical journals, and that statistic on the number of products that have not been independently evaluated for safety it basically comes down to the way our regulatory system works. So these companies that put out these products, their products are basically presumed to be safe for customers until proven otherwise. So they're often allowed to go onto the market. Sometimes they're sort of grandfathered in based on the fact that they use commonly used ingredients already. So there's sort of this grandfather clause going, and there's that they don't really get independently evaluated by the government. The industry can sort of regulate itself. It can solicit its own studies. But again, it's very much up to the companies. And this is in stark contrast to what you see in Europe right now, which is a different kind of regulatory regime that's based on something called the precautionary principle. And in recent years, they've rolled out sort of a multi-year, multi-pronged agenda to, create a regime of chemical safety that basically puts health first instead of the corporate interest.
Hmm. And that's true of the nail industry, or it's true of many other industries?
In Europe, I think it's basically like an economy-wide effort to have better chemical safety regulation because they're looking at, it kind of doesn't make sense to, siphon off cosmetics as this whole separate category and then, and cleaning products is this other thing. I mean, we all are exposed to these things on multiple levels in multiple aspects of our lives, right? And so one of the things that this precautionary principle looks at is how these substances work together holistically in our environment. And that's where I think a lot of the epidemiology has been lacking so far.
We're talking about the nail salon industry this hour of the program. Big expose in the New York Times on May 10. Michelle Chen has written about this in a series of articles for The Nation. She writes, under the searing lights of your local nail salon, looks really do kill. She says that you may have been stunned to learn from the New York Times article that your glamorous fingertips may have imprinted your manicurist's body with scarred windpipes and throbbing headaches. The source of this toxicity has long been hidden in plain sight beneath the veneer of the cosmetic industry. And she talks about the salon workers working sometimes 12, if not more, hours a day, chemical haze, no protective masks or gloves. And it's a huge industry in this country, dominated by immigrants, Asian women for the most part. We're welcoming your phone calls. If you're hearing about this for the first time, what do you think? If you go to get your nails done, will this change the way that you have that experience? What about the number of chemicals that are put into a lot of these products? Should they be better regulated? We certainly welcome your phone calls. Our number, we have lines open for you, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. As a result of all this attention, I do think this has been hidden from view for a long time, that we just are thinking about getting beautiful and will pay any price to have that done. What do you think of all the recent attention on this industry? Will it change it, do you think, substantially, or will this story fade away, Michelle?
It's interesting. I mean, you periodically do see these exposés, and often it's framed around, like, do you know what this nail salon is doing? Scandalous. And people kind of pass it off as, one bad boss or one sort of rotten apple. But I think, the Times investigation was so thorough and got so deep into the industry. I think people are more willing to look more systemically at this. And, guilt does tend to move people. And if this is something that, was already sort of a guilty pleasure, the idea that people can be dying so that we can have nice looking nails, I think is a very stirring insight. I don't know if it'll stick. I mean, one of the things that's changed in New York City, I think, maybe since the recession or since Occupy Wall Street, has been an increasing attention being paid on both a policy level as well as on an individual level to the kind of roiling, egregious inequality that is all over our city. I don't know what it's like in Wisconsin, but I mean, it's basically everywhere, and I think people are more willing to pick up on that and see what they can do about it. It's hard for individual consumers to really, have a huge impact as individuals, but the market is a response to consumer advocacy and consumer demand. And if people are demanding safer products, right, there's definitely one place where the entire supply chain, the entire market for this can benefit.
I can just see some entrepreneurs probably successfully starting nail salon businesses with products that are not as dangerous.
Yeah. And I think there are definitely, you should definitely check out the California campaign for a healthier nail salons, because they've actually started an independent licensing or sort of a certification scheme there, where they actually sort of tag green salons that sort of pride themselves on providing safer working conditions and healthier working conditions for the customers. Consumers can have that knowledge with them when they go out and look for a manicure. They can look for the certification. And although that's still one step away from a stronger regulatory system, it does help the situation if consumers are just made aware of the differences.
Craig in Wausau, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to address or ask a question. Have you differentiated between the materials that are being used from a professional cosmetic industry supplier versus some of the illegal supplies that are being used in some of these nail salons?
I actually am not sure of the preponderance of fake products that are out there. I think it's probably safe to say that whether they're, just generally speaking, these products use a ton of chemicals, and they probably overlap even if they're mislabeled or whatever. If they're fraudulent chemicals, though, then there's actually more regulatory scope in terms of cracking down on them, because I believe the FDA does have jurisdictional authority to crack down on products that actually make false claims. So that is one area where the government can actually be probably more proactive. But the fact is, a lot of this stuff is sadly legal. And these corporations that probably have the most market share are peddling, hazardous chemicals, in our everyday lives. And that goes for cleaning chemicals. It goes for cosmetics chemicals. So, it's not just an issue of mislabeling or misrepresentation. A lot of the stuff, as I said, is sort of hiding in plain sight.
Thanks, Craig. Janice in Antioch. Hi.
Hi. I was telling your person who answered the phone that I was an artist, and I had one craft project that I do during the holiday season, and I needed something that had glitter in it that would stick on glass. And so I started to use glittery nail polish, and I was doing it outside in my garage. I had a fan on to blow the air out of the garage so it didn't hover near me. And I would be out there in November bundled up, and I still got headaches. Mm-hmm. And I would have to have my product sit out in the outside for about 2 weeks so the odor would dissipate and not cause issues if I brought it in the house. And I often thought, how do the women that do nails survive this?
And then you stop making them, I'm sure, right, Janice?
I wait. I got to start now.
Now you have to start to
outside in the wind and the, so that when the weather gets tight, I don't have to worry about it.
Well, maybe you should consider using whether or not you use the product, Michelle.
Well, that's a good story, because you were doing this sort of by choice, right? And it was for a one-time project. And you seem to actually take some safety precautions in your own house. You had a fan blowing and everything like that. And, even as you seem like someone who's pretty on top of things in terms of protecting your health, a lot of these workers are really not in a position to negotiate the conditions under which they work. Many of them do not know, first of all, the proper safety procedures. And sadly, even if they did, they wouldn't be able to advocate for that at work if their boss says no. So, this is really an issue of both how much power workers have on the job as well as the types of health risks that they're faced with.
And finally, an email from Fred in Adams County. Due to health issues, he writes, he has to get his nails cut at a local nail salon. He was so impressed by one worker that he gave her a $15 tip, and the worker broke out in tears.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that everyone can agree on now is whatever you do, just tip generously when you get your next manicure, because that is one immediate way that you can probably put money directly into your worker's pocket and make it a little more likely that she'll get to a place where she doesn't have to face so many risks anymore.
Michelle, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Michelle Chen, she's written a couple articles for The Nation on this nail salon workers' health hazards issue, and she also is a contributing editor at Dissent. She hosts a podcast about various labor issues. As a result of the New York Times expose, New York decided to look at this industry. The governor of the state, Andrew Cuomo, has a bill that's introduced to improve the safety and the health of the people in nail salons, reducing the number of toxic chemicals, employing measures to improve indoor air quality, which is an issue for everybody who's in the salon. We will continue our conversation about these salons with Charlene Obernauer, who became New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health's executive director in January of 2014. She will be with us to talk about inspectors. Are there many on the ground? How will they ensure that salons are healthy? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Charlene Obernauer, executive director of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health. Charlene, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Was it as a direct result of the New York Times' lengthy expose of the nail salon industry that the governor decided to pay attention to this?
That's unclear. You know, the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health has been working on nail salon issues related to the safety and health of workers, related to wage theft within the salons, for the better part of a decade now. And about a year ago, we formed with Adhikar, which is a workers center of Nepalese and Tibetan workers in Queens, we formed the New York Healthy Nail Salons Coalition, which basically aimed to change the regulations in the salons to increase the inspections and the way that New York State dealt with violations, as well as to do simple administrative things like ensure that undocumented workers were able to access nail salon licenses, that they were able to access the exams in their native languages, as well as ensuring that health and safety within the salons was improved. So, you know, we had this coalition going for about a year. We worked very closely with the New York City Public Advocate on introducing legislation at the city level. But I do think that the New York Times expose certainly played a role, and a big role at that, of helping raise the public's radar around worker exploitation as well as health and safety concerns in nail salons. And I think it played a role in having the elected officials take action.
What conditions need to be changed in the salons, Charlene, and how will that happen?
That's a great question. So I would kind of divide it up into two answers here. The first is that the governor has done a lot with these new set of regulations that he's proposed in terms of cracking down on nail salons. And one of the key components that will now be in all nail salons will be a Bill of Rights for nail salon workers, which creates a hotline for nail salon workers to call into when they have health and safety concerns or wage and hour violations. And they can anonymously or via their name call in, talk about the conditions, talk about what the concerns are, and then, you know, hopefully be able to get multiple agencies to respond to that worker's concerns. Additionally, there are new regulations that it puts out related to wearing a respirator when buffing or filing nails or when using artificial nail powder, wearing gloves. It's making the usage of gloves mandatory for workers in salons, whenever you're performing services that could potentially break a customer's skin or handling chemicals. And it also mandates eye protection when preparing, transferring, or pouring chemicals. So these are some new regulations that are within the salons. But anytime, as many worker advocates will know, you know, anytime there's new regulations that come out, there is a backlash from employers in terms of employers, you know, trying to make sure that workers either say that they're being paid the minimum wage or make sure that workers don't report conditions. So, of course, the retaliation piece is going to be huge. And from our perspective, we really need to make sure that workers not only know where to go to report these kinds of violations, but also that employers know that they cannot retaliate against workers for standing up for their rights on the job. These are mostly low-wage immigrant women. They have very little access to resources. They have very little access to power. So when you're thinking about, you know, how can we make sure that these workers are protected, we really need to make sure that retaliation is really cracked down hard on, and that there are many salons that are making shown examples of, you know, those that exploit workers and then, you know, as a result are heavily fined and or shut down if they continue to violate workers' rights on the job.
Charlene, how substantial is the problem of low wages, perhaps illegally low wages?
Very significant. You know, earlier today we just had a worker come into our office telling us that her starting wage was $45 a day. So when you think about nail salon workers working 10 hours a day or 12 hours a day, she's making less than $5 an hour, you know, potentially even less than that. So we're really looking at this being pretty rampant in the industry. The New York Times expose said that workers are making between $35 and $80 a day. We've seen that to be, you know, very much the case, and to see that what commonly happens and was a huge, huge occurrence in the industry is that workers might make, you know, a certain amount per day, and they might work 12 hours, but they're not getting overtime, which is a labor violation, right? So,
right.
You know, you might be making minimum wage, you might be making $8.75 an hour, and then once you work like 45, 50, 60 hours a week, you're not making overtime, which is time and a half. So that would be $13.13 an hour in New York State. And, you know, that's a huge violation, and that's something that needs to be corrected.
Mm-hmm. In terms of protection, it would seem a given that if you're working with all these hazardous chemicals, that you would just, people would think, well, we better wear something to protect our eyes. We better wear gloves because we don't want to work with this stuff hour after hour. It may not be very good for us. Why wasn't it just a matter of course to wear all of those protections?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that some employers don't want workers to wear respirators or gloves or eye protection because they think that it looks bad for the consumer. When a consumer comes in, I mean, you know, we wouldn't just recommend the respirators that, you know, block particulate matter. We would actually recommend that workers wear full respirators that protect them from exposure to harmful vapors, which is a very, I mean, that basically looks like you're going into a war zone.
Whoa.
For people who aren't familiar with different respirators. It's, you know, it's a very extensive respirator to wear on your face. And for the average person, when you go to get your nails done and you're just trying to relax with the girls, you don't really want to see somebody handling your hands like you're a toxic person. You know what I mean? So the employers have traditionally told workers, you know, we don't really want you wearing respirators, or they just won't provide access. So if a worker wanted to wear some kind of a respirator, it would be on them to make sure that they not only purchase the respirator, but also purchase the cartridges, which need to be changed regularly. And that's a big expense for a worker who's barely making minimum wage, if that at all. The second component is some workers, you know, because it's not mandated, some workers don't really want to wear the gloves. They don't really, because it makes it more difficult to do your job. It makes it more difficult to accurately, you know, paint somebody's nails because the gloves can be somewhat of a hindrance. But now in New York State, this is going to be a regulation, so you're going to have to be wearing gloves. You're going to have to be wearing a respirator depending upon what kind of procedures you're doing. So, you know, customers are just going to have to get used to the fact that nail salons are hazardous and workers do need to wear personal protective equipment in order to be protected on the job. And, you know, workers, it might be a little bit of getting used to painting people's nails with gloves on, but, you know, that's the safest way to do it. So we really have to ensure that they're doing that.
Well, at some point you would hope that the product itself would become a lot less hazardous so that perhaps you wouldn't have to wear a respirator. There's something wrong with the product if you have to go through all of that.
It's the product, and it's also ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
So in nail salons, there should be some kind of mechanical ventilation that's taking the old air out, you know, the toxic air out, and it's bringing fresh air in. But there's not good, there are not good regulations around ventilation, and that's actually something that has not been released in New York in terms of an emergency standard, but that is going to be rolled out as a longer term standard and a longer term regulation. So ventilation is huge, and people don't, I think, realize just how critical ventilation is when you're thinking about your exposure to toxic chemicals. Of course, you know, the most effective way to go about this would also be eliminating the toxic chemicals to begin with. But I want to raise an important flag on that, is that right now we talk about the toxic trio, which is formaldehyde, dibutyl phthalate, and toluene in nail salons being very toxic. And, you know, what happens is if we replace the toxic trio, there are safer alternatives. But what often happens when you ban a specific chemical outright is that a new chemical comes and takes its place, a new untested chemical. So, you know, basically what ends up happening is you might successfully ban a chemical and you might successfully ban the next chemical, but new chemicals are constantly being introduced that are not the same chemical compound, but that can be just as dangerous, if not more, as the chemicals that you had previously replaced. So it's important when you're taking these protective measures to not only ban those chemicals and to not only propose safer alternatives, but also to think through as a second level of protection, what is the ventilation like? What are the administrative controls that we can take? And then additionally, what is the personal protective equipment that needs to be worn? You know, it's not one or the other. It needs to be, you need to go down that whole list of ways to most effectively protect workers' health on the job.
What do you think? Are we still going to be polishing our nails a couple years hence?
I think so. You know, it's amazing how quickly people forget these kinds of things. You know, I hope that this is something that we start to see a real growth in the industry in terms of producing less toxic materials. You know, I hope that just like the organic food movement really took off and started to get consumers to think about what they're putting into their bodies, that similarly we think about that in terms of, you know, there are many ways that our bodies absorb chemicals, and, you know, eating is just one of many. So, you know, I think that there's that end as well. But the thing that I've been most impressed with that I haven't really seen in a lot of other industries is people really care about the working conditions of the workers in the salons that they go to. So, you know, you really have an opportunity here where people feel like they have a relationship with their manicurist, with their nail specialist. They feel like they know them. They go there every week. And when they realize just how exploited some of these workers are, they care and they want to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the differences between, say, the organic food movement, where people think about what they're putting into their bodies, but they don't think about the farm workers who are picking those tomatoes, or the farm workers who are, packaging those fruits. This case is different. Most people know their manicurist. They talk to her. You know, and so when they realize the kinds of exploitation that these manicurists are experiencing, they start to think about, how can I be an ally and how can I help support a healthier nail salon industry?
And when you talk about regulation, I believe the New York Times article indicated there are something like 2,000, hard to believe, nail salons in New York City. Do you have enough regulators to make sure they're all doing the right thing?
Ah, that's the question, isn't it? No, there are not. There are definitely not enough regulators. In New York City, we only have 32 regulators at the state level. You know, now there is going to be a multi-agency approach where things like wage theft will be covered by the Department of Labor, things like licensing and health and safety standards in the salons is going to be covered by the Department of State, and the Department of State is the agency that does have the 32 inspectors. So, you know, we strongly believe that a lot of monitoring agencies never have the resources that they need to do their job. And, you know, it's unfortunate. You know, it's a reality of how our taxes are distributed at the federal level, I think, and then how that gets distributed at the state level.
Right.
You know, but at the same time, we need to make sure that we continue to do whatever we can to support the regulation of this industry. Because without regulation, without adequate enforcement, without employers know that if they break the law, they're going to be fined, just like if I run through a red light and there's a red light camera, you know, the employers really need to understand that this is something that is going to be watched, going to be regulated, and ultimately there will be a price to pay for employers that do not follow the law.
Sure.
And that's the message that we want to get out there.
Thank you, Charlene, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Charlene Obernauer, Executive Director of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health. Well, that was an enlightening hour, wasn't it? We want to thank Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Michelle Chen, our first guest, written extensively about the hazardous conditions in nail salons in this country. She's a writer for The Nation, and she's also a contributing editor at In These Times. Charlene Obernauer, just with us, New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health's executive director. And we will post, I think we can do this, some of these articles on our Facebook page if we haven't done so already, so you can be fully armed with the information about how hazardous these nail salons are and what the conditions are, the working conditions, horrendous for many of the nail salon workers, many of them Asian immigrants. Thanks again for listening. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and then we'll talk about food insecurity and if we should regulate what people getting food stamps should eat.